You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2019 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fifth class in a series given by Brother John Popel on the subject, Leading Ladies. This class is titled, The Devoted Daughter, Jephthah's Daughter's Story.
Our final talk, then our final leading lady, again, not one of the obvious choices, perhaps Esther or Mary, from whom much can be gleaned, but a woman, in actual fact, whose voice is so muted that even her name is not given to us, and she suffers the relative indignity of only being known by a relative, Jephthah's daughter. However, there is a happy, if frivolous, corollary to this. I'm told ever more frequently that my father is getting ever more annoyed about the fact that when people meet him, they say, "Oh, are you John Popel's father?" And he replies with no shortage of grumpiness, "No, he is my son." So if you meet him, make sure you do that to him. And if he tries to tell you his name, say, "Oh, no, it doesn't matter." He'll love that. Okay, anyway, so Jephthah's daughter, we really need to know her story. So we're going to take a reading so we can familiarize. The reading is not in any way to fill the time. I want you to try and retain as many details, particularly in the opening 9, 10, or 11 verses, of how this story comes about, because there seems to be a lot of seemingly irrelevant family history to how this system sets up. And in actual fact, almost every single detail has a relevance in explaining what's going on. So Sister Rachel's going to read for us. It's Judges 11, and we'll be taking the first 37 verses, please.
Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior. His father was Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. Gilead's wife also bore him sons, and when they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. "You are not going to inherit any inheritance in our family," they said, "because you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and settled in the land of Tob, where a gang of scoundrels gathered around him and followed him. Sometime later, when the Ammonites were fighting against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. "Come," they said, "be our commander so we can fight the Ammonites." Jephthah said to them, "Didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble?" The elders of Gilead said to him, "Nevertheless, we are turning to you now. Come with us to fight the Ammonites, and you will be head over all of us who live in Gilead." Jephthah answered, "Suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gives them to me. Will I really be your head?" The elders of Gilead replied, "The Lord is our witness. We will certainly do as you say." So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. And he repeated all his words before the Lord in Mizpah. Then Jephthah sent messengers to the Ammonite king with the question, "What do you have against me that you have attacked my country?" The king of the Ammonites answered Jephthah's messengers, "When Israel came up out of Egypt, they took away my land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, all the way to the Jordan. Now give it back peaceably." Jephthah sent back messengers to the Ammonite king, saying, "This is what Jephthah says. Israel did not take the land of Moab or the land of the Ammonites. But when they came up out of Egypt, Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and onto Kadesh. Then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, 'Give us permission to go through your country.' But the king of Edom would not listen. They sent also to the king of Moab, and he refused. So Israel stayed at Kadesh. Next, they traveled through the wilderness, skirted the lands of Edom and Moab, passed along the eastern side of the country of Moab, and camped on the other side of the Arnon. They did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was its border. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon, and said to him, 'Let us pass through your country to our own place.' Sihon, however, did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. He mustered all his troops and encamped at Jahaz and fought with Israel. Then the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and his whole army into Israel's hands, and they defeated them. Israel took over all the land of the Ammonites who lived in that country, capturing all of it from the Arnon to the Jabbok and from the desert to the Jordan. Now since the Lord, the God of Israel, has driven the Amorites out before his people Israel, what right have you to take it over? Will you not take what your God Chemosh gives you? Likewise, whatever the Lord our God has given us, we will possess. Are you any better than Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever quarrel with Israel or fight with them? For 300 years, Israel occupied Heshbon, Aria, the surrounding settlements, and all the towns along the Arnon. Why didn't you retake them during that time? I have not wronged you, but you are doing me wrong by waging war against me. Let the Lord, the judge, decide the dispute this day between the Israelites and the Ammonites. The king of Ammon, however, paid no attention to the message Jephthah sent him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came on Jephthah. He crossed the Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, "If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." Then Jephthah went over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. He devastated 20 towns from Aroer to the vicinity of Minnith as far as Abel-Keramim. Then Israel subdued Ammon. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of timbrels? She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh no, my daughter, you have brought me down and I'm devastated. I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." "My father," she replied, "you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But give me this one request," she said. "Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends, because I will never marry."
Thank you. So this chapter forms something of a problem passage for many, including many of my friends, people that I know, mainly because later in the New Testament, God will openly express his approval of Jephthah. The writer to the Hebrews will include Jephthah as one of the mighty men of valor and one of the men of great faith that are listed in that chapter of the faithful in the 11th chapter of Hebrews. And these are the questions that we can throw up as a consequence of reading that story. Number one, is Jephthah participating in human sacrifice? And if so, how can he therefore be acceptable to God? Is that something which is, under certain circumstances, perfectly acceptable to our Father? If not, if he's not participating in that, well then we have two questions. The lesser question, what actually happened to the young lady? And much more importantly, what then is the story all about? The story isn't about a father who doesn't set fire to his daughter after all, because that's nothing at all. So the story must be about something. Where is God in all this? There seems to be some sort of almighty chaos going on one way or another. Why does not God intervene and prevent whatever terrible thing is going on? And finally, and perhaps most importantly of all, is this really relevant for us? We are engaged with our normal discipleship lives, and that's a right and proper. We are spouses, perhaps. We are parents, perhaps. We are grandparents, perhaps. We have concerns like, I want to make sure my children, my grandchildren are staying away from drink or drugs. Or we have very practical and pressing concerns in life. We have ecclesial disputes and ecclesial fractures. We've got a lot to worry about. Does it really matter? You know, you might think, well, my heart goes out to this young lady from many, many years ago, but at the end of the day, it doesn't actually impact my discipleship. Well, it does, and it should, and we'll see why. Who then is Jephthah? From the reading we've taken, thank you, Rachel, he's a warrior of the tribe of Gad. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior. So he's a known, experienced fighter, which is why when he's thrown out into bandit country, he becomes the chief bandit, and the other scoundrels, as that version so remarkably puts it, gather around him. Nevertheless, he has a defect, if you will, a social defect. No fault of his, he is an illegitimate son. His father was Gilead, who is the leader of the region, is named after himself, and his mother was a prostitute. So he's an illegitimate son, which is a form of defect. That's not my judgment, but it's highly relevant to the story. Most importantly of all, he's a godly man. He recognizes God's hand in Israel. Every battle that is won, he never credits the army. He never credits the commander. He's a mighty warrior. He never credits himself. He always says, God gave us this. God blessed us with this result. God gave us this land. Not our armies took it through our might, but God gave it to us. A man, as we've said, who is commended for his faith. So even in the truncated list of so many faithful people, he finds a place. I do not have time to tell, says the writer to the Hebrews, about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith were all achieved these wonderful things and were all rightly commended for that faith. Here's how the story develops. Gilead's wife also bore him sons. Jephthah's born of the prostitute, of course. And when they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. You are not going to get any inheritance in our family, they said, because you are the son of another woman. So I presume at this time the reason that the sons have the authority to do this is because their father is no longer there and he's passed away. It's not important either way, but I assume that in the culture of the day, the father rules the house, and when the father passes away, that authority actually transfers to the oldest son or the elder sons. And so they're just thinking reasonably, well, there's five of us, let's say, I made up the number, there's five of us, so we all get 20% of the inheritance. However, if we can get rid of that guy, we all get more. And that guy isn't our full brother anyway. So they say, you've got a defect, you have. You're just a half brother. We're not going to get any, give you any of the inheritance money. You're the son of another woman. So they drive him out. Sometime later, the Ammonites attack. And Jephthah is known to be a skilled fighter. He's gone out into bandit country. Not only has he not been killed, he's excelled and become the leader of a group of bandits or raiders or whatever in that zone, in the land of Tob, about 30 miles away, maybe about a day's travel. And sometimes later, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. Come, they said, you can even be our commander to lead us against the Ammonites. Now, who are these elders? Given away immediately, Jephthah said to them, didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? So these elders are his brothers. Okay. Didn't you drive me out? Why come to me now when you're in trouble? So what do we see? We see that Jephthah is embittered. He still nurtures bitterness against his brothers. And it's sometime later. Sometime. Half an hour? 2 weeks? 6 months? How long? Well, by now, he has a daughter that we're going to see is probably a teenager. So realistically, about 20 years. 20 years-ish, plus or minus, have gone by, and he's still mad. With good reason. I mean, he's been definitely mistreated. But in 20 years or so, this is rather maybe a little too soft, sometime later, he still hasn't been able to let this go. This rankles with him, that his brothers threw him out when he was such an asset to the family through his warrior skills. So the elders of Gilead, or perhaps we should say his brothers, they said, don't worry, you will be head over all who live in Gilead. And Jephthah has good reason not to trust these guys from practical experience, and so answers, will I really be your head? And they reply to him, the Lord is our witness. We will certainly do as you say. Is that good enough? No, that's not good enough. So Jephthah actually takes them, essentially, before the Lord. He makes a formal ceremony. He says, no, that's not good enough. I'm not trusting your word. I'll win the battle and you'll turn around and turn on me like you did before. So Jephthah went with these elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them, and he repeated all of the words before the Lord in Mizpah. So he made a formal religious ceremony I win this battle, I'm in charge. I get to say what goes. So Jephthah's desire to have ultimate power is repeated, we're told it, four times in these four verses. That's a critical detail. Why does he want power? And you might think, well, some men are power hungry. That's simply the way it goes. But that's not Jephthah. We know he's not a proud man. We'll see in the next slide. But Jephthah insists on total control of Gilead's people. What is it that he's planning? And that's the point. He's hatched a plan. And for this plan to work, he needs total authority. Is he just power hungry and proud? No. These are the verses, and that's why the reading was so long. We needed all of these verses to see just how godly Jephthah is. He always recognizes God's hand in Israel's successes, be they past or present. Israel didn't take the land of Moab. The God of Israel gave it to you. Suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites and the Lord gives them to me. Not if I win the battle, but if the Lord is gracious enough to grant me victory. The Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites. What right have you, speaking to the Ammonites, to take it over? Whatever the Lord our God has given us, we will possess, not whatever we can take. Let the Lord, finally, here's his stated challenge to the leader. Let the Lord, the judge, decide the dispute this day between Israel and Ammon. So Jephthah is a humble man. His desire for total authority, therefore, does not derive from just being proud and power hungry, as many men can be. But he does need this power for his plan to work. What is his plan? Well, here it is, and it's a vow, and it's a disaster. And he says this. He's speaking now to the Lord God himself. If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Okay? There's the vow. That's what he's put in place. And now that he has total authority over the people, he has total authority to enact this vow should he be given victory in battle. And what concerns us, particularly from our cultural and societal point of view, is did Jephthah really intend to perform or even risk human sacrifice by fire? Why do we care? Part of the reason we care is this is the God that we promote. This is our loving Father. This is the God that we preach and of whom we give witness in 21st century North America and around the world. So we have to answer if someone should turn, as many have turned to me and said, I saw your God. I don't like him. I don't want a God like that. If that's your God, I'll happily go someplace else. Thank you. And that's an understandable reaction on the surface of the matter. Let's remind ourselves of the obvious, and that is to say that sacrifice by fire of humans has always been detestable to the God of Israel. I'm going to put up a few verses, and there's a reason to do this, even though there's a little repetition here. Ahaz sacrificed his son in the fire, following the detestable ways of the nations that the Lord had driven out. Similarly, Israel began to sacrifice their sons and daughters in the fire, provoking the Lord to anger. This is a practice that makes God angry to see this happen. Here are some poignant and hyperbole from Jeremiah. They have built the high places, God himself is speaking, to burn their sons in the fire, something I did not command or mention, and it goes on to say, nor did it even enter my mind. And think about this. This is the infinite mind of God. Everything is in the mind of God, but he chooses to use this hyperbole to say, this didn't even come into my mind that a human would do such a thing. It's that detestable to me. You do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates, says the law. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire. And finally, let no one sacrifice his son or daughter in the fire. Anyone who does is detestable to the Lord. So there's a whole host of verses that show us with great clarity that this practice is absolutely not just forbidden, but detestable. It's the kind of thing that doesn't even come into the Lord's mind. In this context, we meet Jephthah's vow. Whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me, I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. So the first thing I want to point out to you, and it's valid in the Hebrew just as it is in the English, it's not actually the same clause. This is the clause which is detestable. In the fire, in the fire, in the fire, in the fire, in the fire. Jephthah uses a different clause. He says, as a burnt offering. And you might be thinking, well, think ahead, Popel. What do you think happens to burnt offerings? You know, they don't just, you know, spray them with aloe vera and give them a nice massage. You know, that's not what happens. There's fire involved. I get that. I'm aware of that. Yeah. But there's already an apparent implication that he's saying something a little bit different, or a whole lot different, than what's detestable to God, which is literally setting fire to human flesh, be it dead. And here's the most important verse of all. And I haven't heard this verse used in the explanation of Jephthah's daughter, and that's unfortunate, because it should be. It's the most important verse, and if you've forgotten all the others on the previous slide, that's fine. Here's the one that matters. Because in a rare situation, I think there's actually something absolutely provable in the scripture. God is speaking. When you offer your gifts, Israel, the sacrifice of your sons in the fire, you continue to defile yourselves. Am I to let you inquire of me, O house of Israel? As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I will not let you inquire of me. Do you see what that verse says? Allow me to paraphrase it. God says, if you sacrifice your children in the fire, I will not even listen to your prayers. Your prayers will go unheard. Whatever they're for and whatever you want, I don't care. I'm not going to listen if you're going to get involved in this practice. Now, why is that verse so important? It's important because Jephthah does pray. Jephthah does solicit the Lord's assistance. Let the Lord, the judge, decide the dispute this day between the Israelites and the Ammonites. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. God not only listened to Jephthah's prayer, but he granted a favorable response, as Jephthah would have wanted in a human sense, to that prayer. God listens to Jephthah's prayer and responds favorably. Now, it is quite rare that I will ever be dogmatic in a matter, but I think this allows, I feel confident enough to be dogmatic in this one matter and say, this proves Jephthah was never going to set fire to anyone. And the proof is on the slide, so you decide for yourself whether that's a fair comment or not. You set fire to your kids, I won't listen to your prayers. Jephthah prays, and God says, I'm listening, and I'm hearing you, and I'm granting you a favorable response. That is proof positive he wasn't going to set fire to anyone. Therefore, we can conclude, Jephthah is using burnt offering as an idiom. We use idioms all the time. It's going to be an idiom very similar to us saying the whole nine yards or something like that. There are many idioms. This one's a cute one. Yes, that's right. It's a pretty picture, isn't it? Pigs might fly, whatever. We use all sorts of idioms that have no basis in physical reality. But if Jephthah is using this phrase as an idiom, what does it mean? Well, let's remind ourselves what a burnt offering was, apart from the fact it was something set on fire, which we've been able to successfully rule out as an option. If the offering is a burnt offering, then the offerer is to offer a male without defect, and the priest is to burn all of it on the altar. Let's extract the principles. There are three. Principle number one, generally, a burnt offering was a free will offering. It was something you chose to give of yourself. That's not always true. There were a few occasions where it was commanded. But generally, a burnt offering was reserved for something where you actually wanted to do something, make some form of dedication to God for whatever reason. Thanks, a vow, whatever. Okay. Secondly, the subject for a burnt offering was supposed to be a male without defect. Okay. Do not bring a defective male. Do not bring a female. They were reserved, well, females and males were reserved for different types of offering. That's just the way the law was arranged. Finally, and most importantly, the entire animal was utilized. Everything was given. Burn all of it. All of it was dedicated. Every other offering was different in that respect. Only the burnt offering used everything. So Jephthah planned to give a male without defect to the Lord forever, wholly, all of it. That is what we can translate with some confidence is what he's meaning when he makes that vow. We've seen an example of this before. Hannah actually makes a burnt offering the same way. Hannah doesn't use that phrase, and so there hasn't been thousands of years of confusion over what Hannah was saying. And that's fortunate. But it's the same thing. Hannah's vow is exactly the same as Jephthah's. Hannah wept much. She was in despair because she couldn't have children, and worse, other people were mocking her because of that reality. And she prayed to the Lord and said, and made a vow saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life. Let me change Hannah's words without changing the meaning. Then I will give him to the Lord as a burnt offering. Except she didn't use that clause idiomatically. She was more explicit. There's the sacrifice of everything. She sacrifices Samuel as a burnt offering. It's a free will offering. She's not compelled to do this. It comes upon her to offer this. It's a male without defect. Without defect only in the sense that he's given at a very young age before he's set up a life that could have gone astray from God. And he's given wholly as a burnt offering. He's given for life. And what was it that Hannah actually did with Samuel? She gave him her firstborn son for lifelong tabernacle. I've put temple here. Life, same thing, really. For Hannah is offering Samuel for lifelong temple service as a burnt offering. And so here's Jephthah's enacting of the vow, and it all goes horribly wrong. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was an only child. When he saw her, he rent his clothes and cried, Oh, my daughter, you've made me miserable and wretched, because I've made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break. And these verses form a puzzle for some to say, how on earth could he have made that mistake? He's got one kid, his only child, the person upon earth who's going to be most happy to see him come home victorious from battle, the person who's most likely to run out of the front door to greet him. And yet somehow he failed to add that in his calculation. I've heard brothers suggest maybe he just forgot, which seems to me, hopefully the family dog would have beaten her to it, sort of thing. And I can't accept that for a minute, nor do we have to. A much more plausible explanation arises. What is the curious and unusual fact that's given us in that verse? It's right there on the screen. What's wrong with that statement? Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah. Jephthah doesn't live there. It's not his home. So that's weird. Where does Jephthah live? What's the land that he lives in with his merry band of bandits? Tob. Yeah. Jephthah lives in Tob. So when he returned to his home in Mizpah, that doesn't make much sense. It's not the right house. So why is it his home? I live in a little village in Northern California, right by the ocean, beautiful little thing called Capitola. That's where my house is. I rent. I don't even own that house. Nevertheless, there is one other place on earth to which I might be said to be going home. Where is that place? My parents' house. Jephthah lives in Tob. He's going back to his family home. Right? So it's still valid to call it his home. So in other words, he can be absolutely guaranteed his daughter isn't there. His daughter is, should be, in Tob, 30 miles away. Safe as sound. Who's going to come out of the door of his family home? One of his brothers. Does he care which one? Probably not. Hey, I'll let God choose. I'm easy. And yet, most likely, who's going to come out of the house first? Probably the ringleader. And who was the one who orchestrated him being sent away? Probably the ringleader. He's probably going to get exactly the one that he wants. This is a good plan. This cannot possibly go wrong until it goes wrong. He's after one of his brothers. That's what this story is all about. I'm going to get my own back. I've got this down. And then all of a sudden, what on earth are you doing here? Why was Jephthah's daughter in Mizpah? We're simply not told, so I apologize, this can only be speculation. Some theorize that it was a cunning plot by the brothers because they'd figured out what Jephthah was planning and they, you know, captured the daughter and sent her out. I tend to think that unlikely. I don't think Jephthah told a single living soul about this plan. I think this plan was hatched in his brain, shared with God, and no one else ever heard about it. Furthermore, if that had been true, then Jephthah, if he felt he'd been outmaneuvered, sort of in a chess game by his brothers, he would feel rage. He feels no rage. He feels guilt. He feels broken. What have I done? So it's not his brothers have outmaneuvered him. I wonder if our leading lady has in fact planned this herself. My father is coming home. We're to celebrate the Lord's victory. And she's taken a tambourine. Where's she got a tambourine from? Where historically has she thought of the idea to take a tambourine? I think Miriam, quite right, celebrating again God granting victory over Israel. Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her house and all the women followed her with tambourines and dancing. And she writes this wonderful song celebrating God's hand in Israel's victory over Egypt. And I believe that Jephthah's daughter has planned such a wonderful homecoming as well, and a surprise for her father. Oh, he's surprised. That bit worked. But the rest is destroyed. Everything, all the godly plans that she's made are trashed because of his bitter vow. An excruciating irony, therefore, to her father's carefully plotted revenge. And the revenge plot completely stains and despoils the celebration that should have taken place. I think we've solved the mystery at least, but we still haven't answered some of the bigger questions. Let's just step through the evidence. Jephthah is a godly man whose answered prayer proves he was never intending human sacrifice or to set fire to anyone. That's from Ezekiel 20. Very important verse that. He'd been embittered against his brothers for some time, and we've reasoned that's probably about 20 years. He insisted on establishing total authority in Gilead, which would give him power over the elders of Gilead, which were his own brothers. He vowed to devote someone from his family home to the Lord, and he vowed to offer them as a burnt offering, a clause which has caused confusion for far too long, i.e. a male without defect. Isn't that perfect? I couldn't offer myself, brother, because, you know, I'm defective. I didn't even qualify for the inheritance. Sorry. Therefore, I've got to offer you. That's beautiful, isn't it? I enjoy that. There's some real vitriol in there. Jephthah planned vengeance on his brothers by sending one into lifelong temple service. He can even satiate his own conscience by saying, well, I just created an extra priest for the Lord. Can't argue with that, can you? That's a good work right there. My father, Jephthah's daughter replies, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But grant me this one request, she said. Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends because I will never marry. There's an implied piece of evidence there, right, isn't there? Because if she's about to be set fire, I don't think missing her wedding day is going to be front and center. But if she goes into temple service as one of the temple virgins, then she won't lose her life, but she will lose her opportunity to be a mother, which may have been a dear desire of hers. How old was she? Well, clearly these are not the words of a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old. It's a mature response. Nevertheless, she is unmarried. And in that context, where, how old is she? She's 14, she's 15, she's 16, she's 17. She's something of that order, I estimate. So, here's an important point. If Judges 11 isn't about human sacrifice by fire, which we've reasoned it isn't, why is it there? I don't need to know a story about a man who didn't set fire to his daughter, unless it has some point. What's it about? And this is where the relevance comes in. It's about something which has ruined part of your life. It's about something which you may have done to ruin part of someone else's life, and maybe ongoing. It's about bearing grudges. That's what Judges 11 is about. The story of Jephthah's daughter is about bearing grudges. Think for yourself. Well, have a little. Have you ever been a victim of someone bearing a grudge against you? I have. Anyone? Have you ever, could you confess, have you ever borne a grudge against someone else? Okay. And roughly equal numbers either way. And I suggest to you, if you say, what's wrong in my ecclesia, I'll write down the top 5 things. I don't know whether bearing grudges would feature, but I suspect in the top 5, I suspect it would make it into most of your lists. Maybe not number 1, maybe number 1. I don't know. Depends on the dynamics of your ecclesia. Therefore, Judges 11 is one of the most relevant passages in the Bible to today's ecclesial and personal interrelationship problems. Don't be distracted by the notion of fire. It's about bearing grudges. There's few chapters that could be more relevant. And it gets worse than that. Because of the grudge that Jephthah had, it led to taking revenge and pretending it was service to God. Oh, I'm going to put a man into lifelong temple service. He couldn't care less whether the temple got another servant. I want to take down my brother who thinks he's so important and take him down a notch or two. So what are the lessons we get from this particular passage? Keep your promises, as our leading lady Jephthah's daughter encouraged her father to do. In fact, think about God's promise. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who actually may qualify or may receive grace to live on your holy hill? He whose walk is blameless, who keeps his oath even when it hurts. And through the encouragement from his daughter, Jephthah was enabled to keep his oath, even though it would have hurt him very greatly. His own family line, of course, would have thereby been extinguished. Don't bear grudges. There can't be more important lesson than that from Judges 11. Do not bear grudges. And some of you and some of us may have that problem ongoing right now, whether we're the victim or the perpetrator. Let's see if we can do something about that, because our leading lady has taught us through her own tragic example how disastrous they can be. And keep our gifts to God sincere. Don't give a gift to God which is actually masked and disguised as fulfilling some other agenda. You think God isn't going to notice? You think God would accept such a defective sacrifice? He did not accept such a defective sacrifice from Jephthah. He took his daughter instead. Here's the big picture here. Jephthah's father was Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. Well, how'd that happen? Well, Gilead, of course, is the chief ruler in the area. Gilead could sleep with whomever he likes, thank you very much. And because he could sleep with whomever he liked, he said, yeah, okay, I will. That sounds like a good plan. The root cause of this entire tragic sequence was the abuse of power from Gilead, the region's leader. And who paid the price for that? His son. Jephthah had to pay for the price for his father's selfishness. He got booted out of house and home and cut out of the inheritance, not because of anything he'd done, but because his father was selfish. And what happens? What happens with cycles of abuse if people don't learn from them? Well, they repeat, don't they? I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Jephthah sought power in Gilead, like his father had, in order to exact personal revenge, to fulfill his own selfish personal agenda. Who paid the price? His child. You see, that's a duplicate revolution. It's a duplicate cycle. The male in power is selfish, prioritizes his personal agenda, and his child ends up suffering as a consequence. The cycle remains unbroken at this point. Both leaders, fathers, abuse their power for a personal agenda, and both times a family was broken as a result of that selfishness. One of the questions we had left, so the big picture then is to see how God is operating. Where is God in all this? Here's where God is, and so typically, his voice is very, very still and very, very small. And unless you listen really carefully, you won't hear or see God in this picture at all. But he's there, and he's doing the most powerful things so gently and so quietly, you can easily miss them. Jephthah has devoted his teenage daughter to the Lord. We've speculated she's a teenager by the maturity of her spoken response. And Hannah has devoted her young son Samuel to the Lord. The time between these two events varies, according to different commentators, anywhere between 20 and about 80 years, with a median result being around about 3 decades. So Hannah devotes her young son Samuel to the Lord, and Jephthah devotes his teenage daughter to the Lord. Jephthah goes first, by the way, and then this chronologically comes later. So Jephthah's daughter is at the temple, bewailing her virginity, bewailing the fact she cannot marry. And a few decades later, along comes the boy Samuel at age 5, 6, 7 or whatever. So he's building families. Do you see how subtle that is? You don't even notice that's happening, but it's clearly there. Consider, Samuel grew up to respect the Lord. The boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men. But it was not due to his fathering. Now it's, as a general rule, you cannot blame the ungodliness of a son on the father. You can in this case because the Bible tells you can. The Bible says Eli was a rubbish father and as a consequence his sons were wicked. And yet one of his sons or one of the boys in his care was not. Eli's sons were wicked men. They had no regard for the Lord. And the Bible tells us that was Eli's fault. So then, who was living at the temple to be a godly parent to Samuel? There is no doubt in my mind that Jephthah's daughter mothered the infant Samuel and thereby raised one of the godliest men that Israel were ever blessed to experience. So what's God doing in all this? God is providing a mother for an orphaned boy, Samuel, orphaned by a vow, and providing a long-awaited child for the godly leading lady who has been bewailing her virginity. And you wonder, the time is not known exactly to me and cannot be known, but you wonder what could have been going through her mind. That she bewails her virginity, I'll never have a child. And the years tick by and maybe she still trusts in God, and that trust is not fulfilled. And finally, perhaps, that window of opportunity, that window of fertility closes and it's over. And then it isn't because there's Samuel. There's the child she's always wanted. She gives birth, if you will, to Samuel, Israel's last and greatest judge. And I find that beautiful.